and welcome to our WCA 2012 Gascar special all the way from Buenos Aires. Coming up, we've got a slew of discoveries, the best take-home messages from the World Congress, all this plus, as Mark would put it, we talk to some of the biggest cheeses in UK anaesthetics about the WFSA, AAGBI, research and the excellent Lifebox project. I'm Rick Thomas, and with me in the same room for once is Frank Schneider.
Buenos dias.
Sadly, Bex and Mark were not able to make it down to South America, but easily persuaded by the promise of free Argentinian Malbec, we're delighted to welcome two very able stand-ins in the form of June Rahman.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
And Roselle Talak.
Hola.
We'll put some mugshots and bios up on the website so you can see who's talking to you and read a little bit about Roselle and June. So for people who don't know, which included me about 6 months ago, the World Congress of Anesthesia is the biggest international congress of anaesthetists and is run by the World Federation of Society of Anesthesiologists. The World Congress is much like the Olympics in that it takes place every 4 years. There are nearly 10,000 delegates from 122 countries, hundreds of sessions and loads of really great industry exhibits. All four of us have been here for the last 5 days, soaking up lots of knowledge with a side of steak and red wine, and we're going to kick off with our discoveries of the WCA 2012. So, Frank, what have been the highlights for you?
Well, Rick, Bex will be disgusted to know that I've stocked up on loads of discoveries of the month, and I was just going to share one with you today. And in Mark's memory, and in his absence, he'll be delighted to know that this actually made it to his favourite journal, the Daily Mail, back in June of 2009. And I was wondering if anyone had heard of the Lazarus syndrome, otherwise known as the Lazarus phenomenon.
You see it quite often on ITU, don't you?
Oh, do you?
Yeah. You get patients who you think are completely, you know, done for.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later.
It's a well described phenomenon in the literature.
Really?
Yeah.
But people who have been.
Really, I thought it was just a sarcastic comment that
was
made at the end of the bed.
Particularly around Easter.
Listen
time.
On.
Okay.
So, of those of you who, like I, had not heard of the Lazarus phenomenon or the Lazarus syndrome, I came across it not in the Daily Mail, but by an excellent lecture given by Peter Slinger on lessons learned from lung transplantation. And what it's defined as is the delayed return of spontaneous circulation once CPR or resuscitation efforts have ceased. And specifically in his lecture, it was due to, or they think, due to dynamic hyperinflation leading to PEA arrest in patients. And then once ventilation is stopped and the hyperinflation is resolved, there's a return of circulation. We'll direct you on the website to a link, a journal article from the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine. And they think it's actually quite severely underreported, but they've got at least 38 cases. They have an interesting table of the time to return of circulation. One of them, sadly, patient was in the mortuary already. But basically, there are a number of these cases that have been reported. The one in the Daily Mail, I think, was, sadly, someone with congenital heart disease. There are a number of cases reported due to what we think is probably patients with respiratory disease, either COPD or asthma, who have dynamic hyperinflation. And then others are probably due to changes in electrolytes once resuscitation is stopped, or perhaps the sort of longer or delayed effects of adrenaline given during the resuscitation. So as much as I thought when I heard about this initially that it was all made up, it is actually a well-defined phenomenon, and I urge you all to look out for it in your clinical practice. And in fact, it ties in nicely. There's been recent UK Rhesus Council update for ALS teaching that people should take good care when diagnosing or declaring someone dead. And they've recently distributed the guidelines we use in the UK. And in this article on the Lazarus phenomenon, they also obviously stress that you should, or they say between 5 and 10 minutes, but take that time to ensure that there is no pulse and there's no breathing and, you know, all the other things that we look for declaring someone dead.
And maybe to let the APL valve down off the water circuit.
Should we be going to the mortuary to check?
Well, I mean, there's some scary numbers. If you look at the time to, and obviously not, as I say, you know, much of this is probably underreported. Of the 38 cases I think they list, the time to return of spontaneous circulation ranges from a few seconds. There's a few cases where they don't know how much it was, but it does go up to 15 or 20 minutes. So you can imagine that you could, these patients have obviously quite confidently been declared dead, to, you know, minutes, even 15 to 20 minutes later, have suddenly recovered. And there are some cases when they've recovered with no neurological impairment. I mean, there have been sort of other circumstances. Patients have been comatose or hypercarbic for other reasons and seem to have survived without any neurological impairment.
And how do people discover that they're alive? Do they sit up in bed?
Well, I suspect the one in the mortuary...
knocked on the refrigerator door.
In fact, no, there was something about a mortuary attendant getting a bit of a fright.
It's pretty cold in here.
I'd like to complain about the conditions.
But most of the others have been in the hospital setting and they've just picked up by medical staff that suddenly a pulse has returned or there's been movement or other signs of life.
Or self-discharge.
Were they cold when they were dead? Because they say you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
No, but none of them, as far as I can see, have been related to hypothermia, but... That's not someone just recovered from Lazarus phenomenon.
Well, let's move around to June. What has surprised you at the WCA?
I went to a talk looking at disaster relief and mass casualty situations given by an Israeli expert. And he had looked into the disasters that occurred in Spain, the Atocha train terrorist bombings, and also the World Trade Center, and also the Tabor hotel bombing. I don't know if anyone remembers that. But in organizing your hospital for mass casualty phenomenon, he said not only do you triage for those who need immediate care, those who are intermediate and those who are the walking wounded, but you also need to look out for people with the general population within about 100 kilometer radius who have cardiac disease, because there is a incidence of or prevalence increase of 50% of MIs.
Wow.
Within the local population. So they also have an influx of anyone with a history of cardiac disease coming in, and they had to set up a separate cardiac unit and monitor huge numbers of people with chest pain who were about to have MIs.
Just from stress?
Just from the stress of the event within their local environment.
It kind of makes sense, but that's a big increase, isn't it?
That is a big increase.
100 kilometres?
Yep.
Wow.
50%.
When the London bombings happened, there was a sharp increase in the number of people cycling to work because they didn't want to take the tube or the bus. And there was a hypothesis that there was an increase in the number of MIs because of all of the rather large bankers cycling to work who would normally take the tube.
Yeah.
Different mechanism of injury. But
you need a follow-up study of that to see if those bankers then eventually got fit enough and the rate of cardiovascular disease went down.
It was reduced.
Epidemiology study.
Waiting to happen.
Waiting to happen.
Random point.
Okay, so I've actually got three discoveries, but they're all awesome. I don't know if anybody visited the Sonosite stand on the down at the exhibition, but they have the most amazing ad campaign, which I can't really describe to you in too much detail, but we are going to link to it on the podcast notes. So just go down, click on it. There's a YouTube of it. Absolutely phenomenal. Sonosite have spent I don't know how much money doing a movie style trailer telling a story about a doctor who goes and saves some guy on a football field carrying around her new Sonosite briefcase. It's they've got all these sentences like, when's the MRI? She's got something better. And then the patient's sitting there with the doctor putting the probe on him, and he's saying, do you see anything dark? And she's like, I see everything. It ends with this amazing shot of her walking away and her long white coat sort of swishing up. It's absolutely brilliant. And there is a true story behind it as well. So go to the Sonosite website and have a look at that.
We should disclose at this stage that Rick has no sponsorship by Sonosite.
At all. I couldn't work out if the ad campaign is ironic or not. So... So moving round the exhibition floor, something else caught my eye, which was something that looked very much like a bright green Manly MP3 ventilator. I have actually used a Manly MP3 ventilator because one of the hospitals I worked at had a kind of theatre that was away from the other theatres in a separate little building where they did mostly day case stuff, mostly under local, but occasionally an anaesthetic had to be given and people had to be ventilated, and they had one of these Manlys. And if you've ever used them rather than just read about them in one of the anaesthetic equipment books, you'll know that they're a lovely, lovely ventilator to use, and you slide all the weights up and down, set your tidal volumes. And the advantage of them is that they run purely off the fresh gas flow and don't require a pressurised gas supply. So in fact, ideally suited for deployment in difficult environments or in the developing world. So this Manly ventilator was sat on top of an anaesthetic machine which has been around for a while, but is not one I've come across before, and is called the Glostovent, which is made by a company called Diamedica. And what they specialise in is making anaesthetic equipment for middle to low income countries in challenging environments. It was a real example of engineering overcoming the difficult situation. And that situation is having to cope with giving anaesthetics in an environment where you're lacking two essential features which we take for granted, which are pipe gas supplies and a reliable electricity supply. The problem with not having a pipe gas supply is self-evident. You've got no oxygen. And built into this really nice, very robust looking anaesthetic machine is an oxygen concentrator, which is so efficient it can give an FiO2 of 0.95 at a flow rate of 8 litres per minute, which is enough for most things, definitely enough to power the Manly. Underneath it has an uninterruptible power supply, copes very well with the fluctuating current that you get in these type of countries with unregulated power supplies, which are generally very lethal for anything with sensitive electronics. So not only are you secure from fluctuations in power and power surges, you're also well protected if the power goes down. You've probably got enough in the UPS to finish whatever it was you're doing. It has a draw over vaporizer and also modes for pediatric anesthetics.
I used that Glostovent when I was in Malawi, mainly for obstetric patients, and as you said, it's very easy to use and very easy to fix. Easy to use between spontaneous and positive pressure ventilation, and for simple minds like mine, I could figure it out. And it, as you said, it regulates between surges in electrical pressure and regulates for oxygen supply. What I found was it didn't regulate for variations in surgical ability.
But we're all still looking for that machine.
And my final discovery was at the LMA stand. They were having a big push on the LMA Supremes, which I expect everyone's probably seen by now. They're the one with the separate tube that you can put an orogastric tube down. They had, at their stand, they had the world's biggest LMA, which was a massive, enormous skull with this huge LMA with LED lights sticking on it.
About twice the size of a human being.
It was way more. I actually spent some time talking to one of the reps who confessed that she was quite sick of being asked by anaesthetist, what size is that LMA? So thank you for all those excellent discoveries, and this is probably a good time to move on to our first anaesthetic celebrity interview. Frank and I are being joined by the AAGBI President-elect Dr. Harriet Griffiths. Thanks very much for talking to us and welcome to Gascast.
Yes, it's a great pleasure to talk to you, Rick and Frank.
Now, normally at the start of each show, we share with our listeners an interesting anaesthetic-related personal discovery. It can be a concept or a physical thing. Is there anything here at the World Conference that's kind of grabbed your attention that you think you could tell us all about?
It won't be amazing news to you, but I think I've had a bit of a revelation. As you might expect from being president-elect of the association, I'm not young, I'm quite old, and I suppose I've been really quite cynical about the concept of the use of checklists, particularly the WHO Safer Surgery checklist that was introduced in a very mandatory way by the MPSA two, 3 years ago to the UK. And one of the things I've really enjoyed in this meeting is a feeling that there is a lot of work being done by WFSA, and the AGBI is also part of this, trying to take safety out into the developing countries. And there's a great session on safety, on checklists in the developing countries. Where I've been turned round a little bit, I was convinced by a really good talk by Isabel Walker that checklists probably are a good thing. Maybe a better thing in the developing world than in the developed world. But I think that for me was a bit of a revelation. She presented some really, really good data from all sorts of hospital environments that if you focus and concentrate on checklists, they probably actually do improve safety and may actually save lives.
So you've been turned from being a checklist skeptic to, would you say, pro, or now sitting on the fence?
No. I've come off the fence. I was, to be absolutely honest, getting quite a few bad pressure sores sitting on the fence for so long. I've now fallen down the other side of the fence. I've seen the light. I think, yeah, checklist is the way to go. I'm going to be more enthusiastic. I'm going to go and give it a go. I was always kind of the guy in the side of the operating theatre with the arms folded, slightly disconnected from the scrub nurse who's saying, right, everybody, let's introduce myself. My name's Mandy. I've been working here for 13 years with the same bunch of people. Why do I have to introduce myself? So from that sceptical angle, I'm now going to be the person who says, okay, listen up, everybody, let's do it. I promise, absolutely promise. But you know, I think there is increasing evidence, and even the older people like myself who are sceptical, I think we're going to have to change.
Checklists are the way forward. Could you tell us a little bit about the AAGBI's role within, I say WFSA, but I realise now it's WFSA, and what the AAGBI's mission is here at the World Congress?
The Cognoscenti call it WFSA. The AAGBI was one of the key bodies that almost created WFSA. And since then, we've had a very, very close relationship with them. So close, in fact, the headquarters of WFSA is at 21 Portland Place, which is our headquarters in London. So we house them, we're their landlords. And we support many of the aims of the World Federation of Society of Anesthesiologists. And in particular, we're talking about outreach to the developing world. I think anesthesia is fantastically safe. If you are an ASA 1 or 2 patient in a developed country having an anesthetic, your chances of dying as a result of that anesthetic is one in hundreds of thousands. And we sort of like to live in our little developed world cocoon that anesthesia is safe, we're fine. But out there, anesthesia in the developing world can be phenomenally dangerous, and is a high-risk pastime. And very simple things can actually improve safety. I know that you will be talking to Lifebox. We're very much behind that. We're very much behind improving safety of anesthesia in the developing world. And I think that's something where the association and WFSA working together can be really successful. In particular, our current president, Ian Wilson, has got a very long track record of success in education and safety in particularly sub-Saharan Africa. And we're right behind WFSA all the way.
Fantastic. Just while we've got you on this rare opportunity, are there any AAGBI messages that you'd like to give to our listeners?
Well, Rick, Frank, you'll have to apologise for the shameless plug. I particularly like to encourage all your trainees who have not yet signed up for the GATT annual scientific meeting in Glasgow, that's the 27th to the 29th of June, to do so immediately if they can actually take time away from their rotas. I'd like you also to consider coming to annual Congress in Bournemouth in September, where the presidency of the organisation will be handed over from the short, fat, bald one from Scotland, Dr. Ian Wilson, to the posh one from London, myself, William Harrit Griffiths. And that should be great fun. It's always, always great weather. It's always, always a great conference. We'd like you very much to come to that. We'd also like you to engage with our electronic education on the association website. We've got a fantastic video platform. It doesn't compete in any way with GASCAST, but even not being a member, you can go there and have a look at some of the great lectures that we've had over the last year or so in the association meetings. And one last word, if you are not a member of the association, now is the time to join www.aagbi.org.
Well, thank you very much for those messages. I'm certainly already booked up for GATT, but waiting for my study leave approval, as I presume you are as well, Frank.
I am indeed.
Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. One final question. Both Frank and I are very much looking forward to the AAGBI drinks at the Ambassador's Digs.
but as it is the ambassador's reception, will you be serving Ferrero Rocher?
We're going to be very, very careful. There won't actually be any Ferrero Rocher. There will be a selection of Argentinian wines. Every association member attending the reception at the ambassador's residence has asked to be on their best behaviour, and I'm sure they will be.
Of course we all will. Dr. Harriet Griffiths, thank you very much.
It's the day after the ambassador's reception at the British High Commission, and I'm sad to say there were indeed no Ferrero Rocher. But we have found the original advert from 1993, and you'll find a link to that in the podcast notes. So there have been lots of excellent sessions at the World Congress, and we're going to just go around and tell you about a couple of the take-home messages or bits that we particularly enjoyed. So, June, what was the highlight of the conference for you?
So, some of the areas I was interested in, and I was interested in many, but particularly in fluid management. So, interventions to improve patients' outcome. And the latest Cochrane review, which compared crystalloid to colloid, and looking at patient outcomes according to which fluid you used, shown that it doesn't really matter. So most people who would opt for the colloid when they want volume replacement or crystalloid for replacement and maintenance and have their own personal reasons for which they use, at the end of the day, just pick any because the outcome will be the same. But bear in mind side effects and expense. So probably crystalloid is overall best for cost effectiveness. And following on from that, there's another session in monitoring in cardiac patients and the importance of advanced hemodynamic monitoring in solving therapeutic conflicts in the critically ill. And it looked at how you decide whether you're going to give fluids, use a vasopressor or use an inotropes and what you base your decisions on. So if you take, for example, sepsis and the sepsis care bundles, which tell us that we should aim for CVP between 8 and 10, and target heart rate and blood pressure by giving colloid. The general consensus is that that's not necessarily accurate, and even Rivers himself, the pioneer of early goal-directed therapy, has said the most important factor is the antibiotics and not the amount of fluid we give. And we shouldn't be basing our decisions based on CVP, heart rate and blood pressure. We really do need to have some further monitoring such as PICO, looking at stroke volume variation or pulse rate variation to decide what we use. And in fact, we probably give too much fluid, and they think 50% of the time we're giving harmful fluid.
I've got to say, I went to quite a few lectures. I mean, it's an anaesthetic conference, so there's going to be a lot of lectures on fluid, and there's going to be a lot of lectures on cardiac output monitoring. But there was a lot of stroke volume variation and pulse pressure variation lectures, and what there also was a huge amount of CVP bashing. No one is really interested in what people's CVPs are anymore and how that relates to filling. I think we're getting very close to the stage now where we can categorically say that it has very little to do with either your fluid status or what your cardiac output is going to be when you're given a fluid challenge.
So would you, the next time you do a big bowel case, say to the ODP, no, I don't want the CVP connected?
Bring me the esophageal Doppler.
Yes.
Well, like everything, you need a lot of information, multimodality approach.
The more numbers, the better.
Yeah. Well, yes, but CVP is not a useful, is not in that multimodal approach. It's not one of the useful numbers that you're going to have a look at. You're going to be having a look, as you say, at your esophageal Doppler or your LIDCO with your PPV. Or whatever it is that you, whatever hemodynamic monitor it is you are using, but giving a fluid bolus and seeing what happens to the CVP is not a good surrogate for anything.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're quite right. There was a lot of minimally invasive and now non-invasive cardiac output monitoring at the conference. We've covered briefly the Nexfin device in previous podcasts. There's also a new continuous cardiac output monitor that does something very clever with pulse oximetry waveform that we looked at briefly. I mean, obviously, it has clear limitations in terms of peripheral perfusion and the shape of the waveform not working well in shutdown patients, cold patients, so on. But if you were talking about elective surgery, elective cases, then there certainly is a role for these minimally invasive or non-invasive cardiac output monitors and much more reliable indicators of fluid responsiveness than CVP readings. Although I was encouraged to see on one of the lectures that someone was still recommending the passive leg raise.
I love a passive leg raise.
Tell me more.
A little bit of old school that Rizal will be excited about.
I love it. It's when you've got, I've seen it done recently really well. I was standing at the end of the bed in an ITU and I was sort of talking to the consultant and trying to wax intellectual about what I thought the patient's fluid status was. And they had an esophageal Doppler down and he very calmly just went to the end of the bed, picked both the patient's legs up, shoved them up at 45 degrees, and we could see in real time on the Doppler the stroke volume go up. So you know he's hypovolemic. Fantastic.
Physiology in action.
Physiology in action.
I love the simple things.
Yes, they are definitely the best. So, moving on to our next interview. After one of the sessions, I managed to catch up with the new editor-in-chief of the BJA, Professor Ravi Mahajan.
I've just been to the excellent BJA research session, and now I'm joined by Prof. Ravi Mahajan, who's the incoming editor-in-chief of the BJA. So thanks very much for joining us, and welcome to Gascast, Prof. Mahajan.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting.
We're asking all of our celebrity anaesthetists to give us a discovery of the World Congress. What have you seen here in Buenos Aires that you'll be wowing your colleagues with back in the UK?
I think one of the sessions I've been very impressed with is a session this morning, which was a life box session on the pulse oximetry. Although it's not a research topic or it's not something which is at molecular level or lab-based, but I think it is something which is on global scale going to make huge impact. My interest in research, along with quantitative research, is also in qualitative research. And what I will be really interested in is knowing what are the barriers and what are the facilitators that these people are facing in introducing what is life-changing technology in third world. And I think we could learn those lessons because humans are same whether you are whichever world you are in, and it's the implementation science which is quite important. We have lots of interventions, we have lots of guidelines, we have lots of checklists and stuff, but it's most of these things actually fail at the phase of implementation. And I think if we could learn from the life box what they have to tell us in terms of facilitators and the barriers, then we could adapt them to implementation of interventions even in the first world. So I think the there's a theme there which needs to be captured.
And that actually leads me nicely on to what I wanted to talk about. Was we've just heard from you what was exciting in the BJA last year, and I'm happy to say we did cover a couple of those papers on the podcast. But what are the exciting areas in anaesthetic research that we should keep an eye out for in the near future?
Well, if you look at the problems which are being given to us or which are being highlighted, then perioperative, the whole area of perioperative medicine is very exciting. The whole pathway of actually assessing and managing the risk before patients are anesthetized, keeping them risk-free and in safe environment during anesthesia and surgery, and improving, therefore, their outcomes postoperatively. For that to happen in a seamless way, I think that is, I would like to see more research in that sort of area being published in British Journal of Anesthesia. Goal-directed therapy, as you've heard, as you may be aware, is an established way of managing risk, but it's not complete story. It's what is complete story. what other things go with it, and there may be very small bits and very, very large. Are there organizational factors? Are there factors related to hospitals, the way the services are set, the way the rotas are run? What is it that we are not being all that, we're not being able to put all the knowledge that we have into practice? I think more research is required in that area. And if there would be research and papers and outcomes, publication outcomes in the area which is addressing high risk patients and minimizing their risk, I think that would have huge impact on society in general. I'd like to see that being more published in
more of that. So it's the big risk assessment things, outcome measures.
Absolutely, and interventions and their implementation of the interventions. I think that's very important. We have pieces of jigsaw we know are great, but we don't have the connections at the moment.
It's a big picture.
Yeah.
Great, so we look forward to seeing those in the next year in the BJA. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
So thank you again to Professor Mahajan for that interview. So, Frank, what did you learn in your 5 days in Buenos Aires?
Well, as Gene was saying, there was a lot to go to, and I certainly am storing some of it up for future podcasts. I was going to share a few things with you, and there are a few studies I'm going to mention which I'll telegraph now, but look like good candidates for discussion in the upcoming podcasts once the studies are released. I would just add to June's comment, because I also went to interventions to improve patients' outcome, and she's quite right, we are none the wiser when it comes to the whole fluid debate. We're also not much the wiser when it comes to steroids, apparently, although there is some interesting research going on with that. And the only other thing I would add to that is that, and I didn't know this, but apparently, and these studies were done on Ringer's lactate, but crystalloid can cause apoptosis in end organs and immune dysfunction, and that's generally in fluid resuscitation with crystalloid given at quite high rates. Also, there was debate, or there is debate now, whether albumin may be protective in sepsis, and that was in Delaney's meta-analysis in Critical Care Medicine, which just showed some decreased mortality in septic patients receiving albumin-containing solutions. And also, this is one of the studies I was going to just telegraph, is the Albios trial, which is the Albumin Italian Outcome Sepsis Study. And this comes from the Gattinoni stable, which I'm a big fan of all his work in respiratory, or the respiratory research he used to do with ventilation ARDS, obviously. But this does sound very interesting. It's a randomized control trial of its albumin versus crystalloids. The primary endpoint in sepsis, obviously, the primary endpoint is 28 and 90-day mortality. And the results should be available in May 2012 if clinicaltrials.gov is anything to go by. The other trials that are going on are dexamethasone, light anesthesia, and tight glucose control. And that's looking at the effect of steroids, glycemic control, whether that's tight or to normal, and depth of anesthesia on perioperative inflammation and morbidity, and that's in major non-cardiac surgery. And then the last two things I thought I would mention, and I don't know if anyone around this table has heard about the triple low.
No.
There was quite a lot of chat about triple low, and I think that's one of the benefits of these international conferences, is that you do really get a perspective from other nations and what people are discussing in anesthesia there. But triple low is essentially the combination of low BIS, so less than 45, a low MAP, less than 75, and a low MAC of less than 0.7. And that combination nearly triples the risk of 30-day mortality. And having done a bit of research just on the internet here, it seems like that's been discussed in the States for quite some time, certainly since around 2009 or so. And one of the other things that was impressive at this conference was that certainly the Americans, and possibly elsewhere, but many of the talks I went to were from American centers, but they have a huge amount of data that they automatically gather on patients as they go through the sort of perioperative journey. And a lot of this information has come from retrospective analysis of that data, so they've obviously pulled out patients with increased mortality and realized that they had this combination of low BIS, low blood pressures, and low MAC. And anyway, from that has come the development of a prospective cohort study, which is currently underway in recruiting, And again, that will be something to look forward to, see what the results have to say. The thinking obviously being that a low BIS, so overzealous anaesthetic perhaps, a low blood pressure, and the low MAC, obviously meaning that patients didn't need a lot of anaesthetic to stay anaesthetized, and the implications of perhaps poor reserve or the degree of severity of illness that they exhibited.
You mentioned this to me before, Frank, and actually I was having a little think about it, and it's a really interesting observation. Just in case I can't get any of this out, we're not in fact recording the podcast in a gentleman's toilet.
You are not.
we're recording in a flat.
Again,
and,
commenting on the ability of Argentinian wall architecture.
It's really poor build quality, and the person next door seems to be filling filling the kettle or something, which is massive and from some kind of great height.
Or has had as much Starbucks coffee as Rick.
So we apologise for that.
So the message from that is don't over-anaesthetise your patients.
Well, no, this is the thing. Yeah. I don't think that's the... That's on the face of it, that seems to be the message. But the triple low is about the low MAC and the low BIS. So in actual fact, these patients had something different about them beforehand. They're people who are anaesthetized to a great degree by not very much anaesthetic. This is not something the anaesthetist can necessarily change.
Oh, so they have some sort of metabolic or enzyme...
or cardiovascular instability,
hypovolemia. Yeah, but not very much anaesthetic. Really puts them to sleep and really depresses their cardiovascular system. So they're physiologically not right before you start, or whatever their physiology is giving them a propensity to a mortality rate that's three times higher.
Are they very elderly?
Yeah, they didn't share the breakdown of that kind of information, although I'm sure it's available. And I did go to one talk where... What was interesting is that you did need all three factors to have this hugely increased mortality. So even if you only had two out of three, it didn't have the same effect. And obviously one out of three didn't give that effect at all. But patients that had a low BIS as well as a low pressure but didn't have a low anaesthetic requirement didn't show this increased mortality, and obviously all the other combinations as well.
So that would go against us being the perpetrators of that. If they had a low BIS and a low MAP, but a high MAC, then that would be because we were over-anaesthetizing patients.
Yeah,
but
precisely.
And a MAC of 0.7, that I would be quite happy with that. And a
MAP, you might be a bit worried about that.
And a MAP of 75? That's all right.
That does seem high, but I'd be quite worried about someone. I wouldn't be worried.
Have I just declared myself as a terrible anaesthetist?
No.
There's a website about it.
Well, what was interesting about, because they collect all this data, and I mean, part of the sort of outcomes, improving patient outcomes was about that, and the sort of technology that they've invested in, and the challenges and difficulty that we're not unaccustomed to in the UK. But their great ability to look at all these numbers, and what was interesting about that is that they actually have reasonably low MAC values on average, and I think their average MAC was about 0.6 or 0.7. It wasn't as high as you would have expected in terms of maintaining anaesthesia, and that's without looking at other factors.
That's definitely the lowest limit of normal I would be happy with.
But when you know you're giving opiates or something else as well.
But do you guys regularly use a BIS monitor?
No,
that's the thing.
Well, it also goes to show that this is coming from centres where the study is being supported by Covidien, the manufacturers of one of the BIS monitors. So all the patients have got BIS monitors, so they have got that data available, which obviously is not the routine in many other places.
But it is, as you were saying, Roselle, it's not something that we are able to alter as anaesthetists. It's something that would be halfway, well, at the beginning of a procedure, take a note of at the moment and be like, that's a shame. This patient now has a triple mortality risk because there seems to be something wrong with them, but we're not actually any closer to knowing what it is. But that will come with time, I'm sure.
Or even knowing what intervention we need to bring about to improve their mortality.
Yeah, because
Well, I think there is, I mean, there I was aware of some evidence showing that low BIS values had an increased morbidity, don't think mortality, but certainly poorer outcomes. And again, there's a lot of talk at this conference about, you know, people speaking about this, that they certainly keep the BIS values, try and keep them aim for somewhere between 50 and 60, rather than towards a 40 end, and certainly not less than 40, or if you believe the triple O, less than 45.
Mm. Well, thanks, Frank. That's loads of stuff, and you look pretty set for the next 6 months, I would think, then.
I do. Look forward to my talk on troponin T.
So, moving on to our next interview, I managed to grab the eloquent and eminent Professor Pierre Foix in the equally glamorous setting of the conference canteen.
I'm joined by Professor Pierre Foix, who has just delivered one of the state-of-the-art lectures here at the World Congress. Thanks very much for joining us, Prof Foix, and welcome to Gascast. You're an expert on how best to assess the risk and prevention of cardiac events in the perioperative period. I listened with interest to your talk on the current state of play with regard to the risk of undertaking surgery in patients with coronary stents and antiplatelet therapy. This is a common and tricky problem facing the jobbing anaesthetist. How far away do you think we are from a clear set of guidelines, and what upcoming research should we look for to guide our practice?
I'm afraid we are probably reasonably far from having guidelines that are based on strong evidence. The guidelines as they are at the moment were prepared at a time there was essentially no information, observational or otherwise, and it was mostly using logic and say patients have stents, they are on antiplatelet therapy, we should wait until they are no longer under dual antiplatelet therapy to operate, which is impractical. But that was done in 2009, based on guidelines in 2007, and at the time there were 450 patients reported in the literature. Now there are 8,000 or 9,000. And what is needed is to analyze the data. But that is a very complex task, because not two observational studies have used exactly the same criteria for defining cardiac events, for defining what was going to be done in terms of dual antiplatelet therapy, and as a result, trying to analyze the data and extract guidelines is difficult. But what I think starts to emerge, and I'm currently preparing a review, and it's more difficult than I expected. In preparing this review, what I find is that the data, for example, on delay after stenting for undertaking surgery, 1 year for drug-eluting stents, doesn't seem to rest on data. There are studies now showing that probably after 6 months, the risk has declined quite substantially. Early on, it's very clearly contraindicated, but that is not really an answer, because some patients may need surgery. And I think the main message today, in the absence of clear guidelines, is if a patient has received drug-eluting stents and is on dual antiplatelet therapy, it is imperative that a discussion takes place involving surgeon, cardiologist, anesthetist, and the patient. Because after all, if there is massive bleeding or complications thereof, or stent thrombosis, it's the patient who suffers. And I think it is important. I still hear at meetings when I talk about stents, colleagues saying, oh yes, but in our institution, the surgeon will stop dual antiplatelet therapy 1 week before surgery, and the patient arrives on day 6 to the coronary care unit, and we haven't heard about this patient before he's not coming for surgery, and we are told, oh, the patient couldn't have his operation because he's in coronary care. And I keep hearing that, and I think this is the only very strong feeling I have today, it has to be a joint decision. And in Oxford, I've been fortunate to discuss with my colleague and the cardiologist, and they will not hesitate 1 second and say, if a patient presents for surgery with stents, we want to know, because we want to be in the loop, we want to be able to advise, but also be prepared to jump in. Should there be stent thrombosis, we can do an angioplasty there and then. But if we don't know, we're not going to be there to do it. And I think that is before we know more about exactly when you can operate and forget about dual antiplatelet therapy, which may be 6 months with the Xeons stents, which are everolimus and different structure. Maybe 6 months is more than enough. But before we know that, it's a decision where everybody can contribute. And I think that is all I would say to people who are involved is, whenever possible, and it should be possible, is to make sure that people have discussed the case and everybody is appraised of the consequences one way, stopping, or the other, continuing with dual antiplatelet therapy.
So think very carefully about what it is you're going to do. Make sure that everybody's on board, yeah, especially the cardiologists, and wait for you to finish your review.
I think, unfortunately, the review may be inconclusive.
As
we may not have enough data, or the complexity of the data will make the review end up by saying, 5 years on, because we wrote a review in 2007, 5 years on, there's more data, but it's still confusing, and all we can say is the advice we suggested 5 years ago remains true. It's a joint decision.
Thank you very much, Professor, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much.
So, Gaskell's really has got the scoop there on coronary stents, straight from the man himself who is working on the problem. So, moving round, Roselle, what at the WCA have you found that's going to revolutionise your practice?
Well, I attended one of the talks on morbid obesity and how it impacts on anaesthesia, and I discovered an acronym for predicting OSA in patients who hadn't yet been tested for it. So the acronym is STOP-BANG. Has anybody heard of STOP-BANG?
No.
Well, letter by letter, S is for snoring, T is whether they're tired during the day, O is for whether they've been observed to stop breathing at night, and P is for pressure, as in increase in blood pressure. The BANG, B is for a BMI of greater than 35, A is for age greater than 50, N is for neck circumference greater than 45. Do we know anybody who might fit that description? Which would translate into a neck circumference in inches, which I understand men are more used to using, as greater than 17.7.
And I am 16.5, so in a few years I hope to fulfill the criteria.
And G is gender equals male, so you already fit that criteria.
Two out of seven. How many factors is that? Seven, no.
Eight. Two out of eight.
So you fit
quarter of the
well
criteria.
On my way.
That's quite a lot of things to go through. But easy to remember, because it's exactly the sort of person you would not stop to bang.
You're going to leave that in there.
In other words, you would bang.
But is, you know, in criticising that, how many obese patients fit those criteria? Most do.
Well, I think the interesting thing about that is neck circumference, because I have never, ever recorded somebody's neck circumference.
No, but you just have to look at them, you can tell.
Yes, but I think that identifies the fact that BMI on its own is not a useful predictor in OSA. So the distribution of the fact, whether it's android or female fat distribution, makes a difference. So android fat distribution is very central and around the neck and is going to cause us more airway problems.
Say you have an obese patient with a large neck. What are the chances he's tired, hypertensive and snores?
Very high.
Yeah. So you can do that.
I mean, the chances he has a degree of OSA is probably quite good as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. So maybe we should presume that they have OSA until proven otherwise.
Exactly.
And how's that going to change your management?
That's going to mean that when I anaesthetise patients, I'm going to be prepared for a difficult airway, position them appropriately, ramped up position, rather than lying with flat on their back with their neck extended, and give them a lot of PEEP when they are intubated.
Nice.
And probably go for a ET tube rather than an LMA.
There is a nice little final FRCA Viva moment for you.
Did I pass?
I think you did.
You're still not going to go HDU bed, though.
Excellent. In life, everyone has their biggest regrets. Roselle's is that when she turned around to the president of the AGVI, when he was explaining to her his idea to make pulse oximetry a global standard, and she told him it was possibly not going to work. So the real star of this year's World Congress has been the LifeBox project, which is all about getting pulse oximetry the recognised place it should have as a patient safety monitor. So to redeem herself, Roselle's going to introduce this interview.
One of the highlights of the WFSA conference was being able to catch up with the instigators of the LifeBox project, Dr. Isabel Walker and Dr. Ian Wilson.
LifeBox has had a huge presence here at the WCA 2012 in Buenos Aires, and we're very privileged and fortunate to be joined now by Ian Wilson, President of the AAGBI and a member of the LifeBox Foundation Board, as well as Isabel Walker, Consultant Pediatric Anaesthetist at Great Ormond Street, who's the AAGBI representative on LifeBox Board as well. Now, we attended the Harold Griffith Symposium yesterday. First of all, we'd like to congratulate you on the receipt of the Harold Griffith Medal for your lecture, Making the Dream a Reality. Perhaps we could ask you, Dr. Wilson, to just start off by telling us a summary of what you gave us in the lecture with regards to the LifeBox project.
Well, thanks very much, Frank, for the opportunity and for the congratulations. I have to say, I had no idea there was a medal coming, and it's about the only one I've received, so I was very pleased with that. The LifeBox project started a few years ago with the work at the WHO. We're run by Dr. Gawande, developing the WHO checklist. And during the development of the checklist, we were very keen that an oximeter would become a basic standard of care for international anaesthesia. As you know, many places in the world are working in impoverished circumstances where that basic monitor, which is an absolute standard of care in the UK and any other wealthy country, are affordable and are used for every patient. And we made the point that the mortality associated with anaesthesia in many places is so high, and mostly due to airway problems causing hypoxia, and then patients can die from this. So we managed to convince the WHO of the role of putting oximetry on the checklist, and then the problem became after that how to source a reliable, high-quality pulse oximeter, which could be used anywhere in the world, would be robust enough to be dropped from a height and would still function. It obviously needed to be battery-powered and be able to be recharged in the mains, because electricity often fails in the middle of surgery in these places. So we put out a tender through the WFSA, and the eventual winner of that tender was ACARE, who now supply the LifeBox pulse oximeter. So it sounds like a very easy process, but it's taken many hours of work to register a new charity, develop contracts with ACARE, develop a website through which we can get people to go on and buy the pulse oximeters or donate money. What's been remarkable, I think, is the interest the project has attracted through not only just anaesthesia, but also the greater medical press. Many anaesthesia societies, the ASA in the States, the New Zealanders, the Australians, Brazil, the UK, and many others have actually raised money in specific ways to support projects and the distribution of pulse oximeters. And I think you've been to our stand and you can see the sort of work that's going on at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, you've had a fantastically busy stand, and you know, we're very pleased. As I said, it's had a huge presence at this conference, and you know, we're very pleased to see the amount of support we're getting across. We're just speaking about anaesthetic societies across the world really getting behind this project. And Moving on from there, we were speaking earlier about the project in Uganda. I was wondering, Isabel, if you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, we've had a very long association between ourselves and the ITSA GBI and the Uganda Society of Anesthesia, particularly a very inspirational anaesthetist in Uganda, Stephen Tendo, who's the president of their society. We've realised over the years that the situation in which anaesthetists are working in that part of the world is really very, very difficult. So working with very sick patients, often with very poor facilities, and frequent with no monitoring at all, apart from a finger and a pulse and a stethoscope. So for the Ugandans, the Ugandan anaesthetist, Lifebox was incredibly important. So we ran a training course for Lifebox in June of last year, and Stephen managed to gather anaesthetists from, and these are anaesthesia providers, they're non-physician anaesthetists, and there are only a handful of physician anaesthetists in Uganda. So gathered the anaesthesia providers from all over Uganda, from the most remote rural hospitals, and brought them together for some training for Lifebox. We trained them about the oximeter, how it works, what an oximeter does, because if you've never worked with an oximeter, it's very difficult to know, you know, what the number means. Is 80, is that good or is it not good? So it was really important for us to teach people about oximetry, about what to do if the saturation falls. There's an algorithm that we teach. And also about the checklist, because we know the checklist has a major impact on outcomes in high-income countries, but also in low-income countries as well. So the training was oximetry and the checklist. Got some fantastic feedback from the course participants. We asked them to write essays at the end of the day to tell us what they felt the impact of the checklist would be and the impact of oximetry. And some of the stories that emerged about how they really are doing their very best for patients in the most difficult circumstances, and they could see the benefit of the interventions that we're doing. It's really very, very impressive.
And that underscores another important aspect of this, which is the educational aspect. I mean, one of the things that we liked about it is that we're not simply supplying a piece of kit and leaving it in an area of need. And we heard Dr. Enright yesterday talk about that, and the fact that this educational material being produced is freely available, is freely able to be adapted for local needs, and that in fact, every Lifebox has a safe surgery checklist in it with the education material, so that you can almost guarantee that it goes out with the equipment.
It was fascinating, because as part of the educational material, we give people a logbook, and we ask them to fill in the cases that they do, and we ask them to record the minimum saturation. And then we followed up the oximeters, and we followed up the individual providers in their hospitals, and we looked through their logbooks. And you can see over time, they're starting to adapt their practice. So we're seeing a real impact of the education, because the incidence of hypoxia that they're recording is going down. It's simple interventions like in recovery, I notice my patients desaturate and I give them oxygen. I notice that when I intubate a patient, they desaturate and I pre-oxygenate before intubation. I think we have no appreciation of what it's like to work without any monitoring, and this has made a huge, huge difference.
You've managed to distribute an incredible amount of Lifebox pulse oximeters already. How do you know that they are being used and that people are receiving the benefit that was intended with the distribution?
We were lucky, Frank, because we had one of the registrars in Exeter called Louise Finch asked whether she could come and work with Lifebox for a period of time, and she was able to get a travel grant from the AGBI to do this kind of research. It's called an AGBI fellowship, and she travelled around the country going to all these anaesthetic offices that Isabeau has talked about, had a wonderful experience, but at the same time has come back, and we're looking forward to seeing her paper on the topic being published somewhere, because it's a real test of the project. Can you deliver? And the pulse oximeters are still in use, and the education's worked for us. It's very exciting.
And one of the comments that Louise made was just how grateful the recipients were, not only for the donation, but also for the educational input, and the fact they were so pleased that another anaesthetist had come to visit them in their place of work. She said she got showered with gifts, including a chicken.
It must be tricky to take across the border again. Well, we saw some of her data, but I just wanted to highlight that. I think, was it?
Of the 79 given out, 78 were in use. Two of them were temporarily not in use because there wasn't a surgeon working at the hospital at that point. One had gone to Sudan with the anaesthesia provider. And one of the things we've done in Uganda, Frank, is to give the pulse oximeters directly to the anaesthetic officers who will be using them, and we think they'll look after them better with that approach, and certainly Louise's data would tend to support that. What we would like to achieve as a charity to ensure that any donation for a pulse oximeter, the charity can tell where the pulse oximeter has gone and the name of the person or people that are using it. We're well aware of the reputation of charities and of giving aid to international hospitals where things are seen to not be effective. We want to steer well clear of that. And since we work anaesthetist to anaesthetist, we've got a better chance of pulling that off, I think.
And I've just had a really good meeting with the vice president of the Ethiopian Society of Anaesthesia, Dr. Asifu, and she's going to follow the model that we've used in Uganda, and we're going to target remote areas in Ethiopia and again do the same thing. So we're going to donate the oximeter to the individual provider, letting the Ministry of Health know that that's where the oximeter is, and also the superintendent. So it becomes a treasured possession of that individual, and they have a responsibility to look after it. I think it's a good model, and it means that they will be well used and well looked after.
One of the interesting bits of the project, Frank, is that the anaesthetists are sort of helping other anaesthetists around the world, and that's a lovely aspect of it, which is really the aim of the WFSA, to enhance patient care through all member societies. It's not just anaesthetists who've been tremendously helpful to us, though. We've had great help from law firms, from advertising firms like Lehman Millett, who made the video which you saw. And anything about the project is on the Lifebox website, www.lifebox.org. And we encourage people to go to that and let us know if they'd like to get involved. We're open for ideas, suggestions, criticisms, and anything, because it's a big task, and we would be very grateful for input.
Some of the fundraising activities have been really impressive. It's groups of trainees saying, look, here's a school of anaesthesia. There's one school in the States. They're having a fundraising drive. And another school of anaesthesia saying, well, how about if we do the same thing and maybe we can match them as well. It's very nice, actually. And it's that the feeling that of anaesthetists being united around the world to improve care of patients. It really is a very, very heartening project.
So, as we've been saying, there's been some fantastic support for Lifebox. Here at Gascast, we're actually putting our money where our mouth is, and we've decided to buy a Lifebox between the four of us, and we would set the challenge to all our listeners, wherever you may be, to really try and champion this cause in your local departments if you've not heard about it. And as you've heard today, there are lots of opportunities, a fantastic website to go onto. That's www.lifebox.org again. So if any of you out there would like to rise to the challenge, we'd be very pleased to hear about it. So if you send those names in to us, either on the website or through the Twitter account, and we'll certainly keep on advertising them over future monthly podcasts. Once again, thanks very much, Ian Wilson, Isabel Walker, for joining us, and thanks for all your energy and the hard work that you must have put into the Lifebox project.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Thanks for that, Frank. Lifebox really was the star of the World Congress this year, and we are really big enthusiasts of the entire project here at Gascast. We're going to try and find out what's happened to the oximeter we've bought and where it's gone, and we'll let you guys know. And we're really looking forward to hearing about how you're raising money for Lifebox, how many you've bought. So send in your stories, and we look forward to reading them out. So it wouldn't be an episode of Gascast, even if it is a special, if we didn't finish off with a quick round of Biology or Bunkum, which I'm sure, as you can predict, is Argentinian themed. So, June and Roselle, obviously new to this game, but have had the rules explained to them. So here are your three stories. Number one. There have been two Argentinian recipients for the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Number two, the Argentinosaurus is a dinosaur that is largely thought to be.
Honestly, can you largely thought to be?
Oh,
The Argentinosaurus is a dinosaur, bones of which are obviously being found in Argentina, and is thought to be the heaviest creature ever to have walked the earth. And number three...
I think that's me after a week in Argentina.
And number three, the Cueve de los Pies is the oldest evidence of indigenous culture in the Americas and dates back to 11,000 BC. I'll explain. The Cueve de los Pies is the cave of feet where there are a load of paintings of indigenous people's feet.
Does it smell? Feet?
No, they're kind of tracings.
Of feet?
They're a type of cave painting, but they are or feet.
Feet.
So one of those is Buncombe. Which one is it? We're going to not start with Frank, because being of South American extraction, he's got an obvious advantage here. So, Roselle, which one of those is a figment of my imagination?
I think C, because it sounds the most plausible.
C, because it sounds the most plausible.
Yes, therefore you're playing with my mind, and I think it's... therefore.
Many have tried that reverse psychology and failed.
Well, that's like double reverse psychology.
Yeah.
It's so plausible that you're playing with my mind that it's not.
Yes.
Interesting.
Well, for the same reason, I think two, which sounds like the most obvious bunkum tale.
You're not a fan of
it. I'm not. I'm going to say it's probably true, because it's just too ridiculous to be false. So...
given
that
we've
double negative psychology, I will say number one is false.
Interesting. So, Frank.
Well, I'm going to go with number one is false, too. I think there's been one. I think there may have been one Argentinian Nobel Prize winner in medicine, but not two.
I would have thought more than two.
Ah.
Mm. Okay.
Given the number of morbid obesity talks I've been to this week, I think that there clearly has been a study into who's the heaviest and presumably...
the Argentinosaurus.
Yes.
Argentinosaurus wins it. So, Frank and June are going for number one, and Rosella's going for number three with her reverse psychology tactic. So, we'll start with number two, which was the Argentinosaurus. Which, June, you're quite right. I did pick it because it does sound ridiculous, but it is in fact entirely true. The Argentinosaurus is of the genus Titanosaur, and did apparently...
We
roam,
all need to work into conversation this evening. Titanosaur.
Titanosaur.
Or your next poster.
Yes.
I'm not sure which international meeting will take a poster on Titanosaurs. But yeah, that was thought to be the heaviest creature to walk the earth, between 60 to 97 tonnes, they estimate. They've only got a couple of bones from it.
Oh, thankfully I weigh in under that.
Safe.
Yeah.
Safe, not yet. And was roaming around South America when it was a separate continent, which I didn't realise it was. So...
which one?
Frank... oh, keep that suspense going. Chris Tarrant. So Frank and June... you don't think that South America, or Argentina in particular, can produce two Nobel Medicine laureates?
More than two.
More than two?
Yes.
Oh. Well, I don't know if the whole... can't speak for the whole of South America, but Argentina has produced two Nobel laureates for medicine.
Yay!
Bernardo Hussey in 1947 for discovering the role that pituitary hormones play in glucose regulation.
I can't believe you didn't know that.
And Cesar Milstein in 1984, and he pioneered the technique that produces monoclonal antibodies. So that is in fact completely true, which means you are quite right, Roselle, but for all of the wrong reasons.
It just shows it's all about the end result.
And this is actually one of the ones with a small twist. It's actually Cueve de las Manos, not de los Pios. So it's actually some cave paintings from around, well, they carbon date around 11,000 BC. In Patagonia, that are thought to be the oldest evidence of indigenous culture within the Americas, and somehow they've made some kind of, I think it's almost like spray paint out of chalk, but there's loads, and there's, if you look, we'll put the link to the Wikipedia site. What's interesting is that it's mostly left-hand prints that are on the cave, because they then sprayed or traced around with their dexterous hand being their right hand, and as long with a load of other cave paintings, there are all these hands all over each other in there. That doesn't sound better.
Ruder than it is.
They're not in fact porny cave paintings, they're just tracings of hands. But they are indeed the oldest evidence of indigenous sculpture. So very well done to Rosa.
Another bottle of Malbec for me.
Absolutely. So that wraps up our WCA 2012 special. We've all had a fantastic time here in Buenos Aires. A big thank you to June and Roselle for filling in for Mark and Bex, and a special thank you to all of our anaesthetic celebrities who gave up their time to feature on the podcast. We'll be back with episode 10 towards the end of the month. We'll catch you then, and thanks very much for listening.
Adios.
Adios.
Hasta luego.